Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I'm Ken Levine, your podcast host, and this is an episode I'm slipping in last minute. One of my comedy writing idols passed away at the age of 91 a week ago, Bob Ellison. Bob had been working on variety shows and situation comedies. He wrote 15 episodes of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. He won a couple of Emmys. He was also a creative consultant, meaning that he was a script doctor. And many of the great jokes that you laughed at over 30 years of television were written by Bob Ellison. Well, 5 years ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing him for this podcast, and he rarely gave interviews. He was very shy, and I really had to coax him into doing it, and he actually had a good time. But I thought, in a tribute to Bob Ellison, one of the truly great situation comedy writers of all time, that I would reintroduce you to Bob and replay my interview. So this, again, is from 5 years ago, and my tribute to the great Bob Ellison. Okay, you know, there are stand-ups who, in the stand-up world, they're called the comedian's comedian, where other stand-ups really admire them, but the public doesn't really know who they are. And in many ways, you're kind of the comedy writer's comedy writer, because you have spent many years kind of behind the scenes as a creative consultant, and a lot of the great jokes that people have laughed at in 20, 30 years are jokes that you came up with, but you're not credited for. You are sort of a creative consultant. What exactly is the role of a creative consultant?
The role of the creative consultant is usually come in one day a week.
Right.
On a troubled script and go to a run-through or a reading and find out what the problems are and try to fix them.
Okay.
And sometimes it involves jokes that don't work, and that's when you jump in. And a lot of times it involves keeping the room alive. The guys have been through this for the whole week, and morale is pretty low.
Right.
They've been beat up on the stage and in the room, and you come in and try and pick them up and get everybody working.
Is it fun? I mean, you always seemed like you were having a good time doing it.
Always.
Uh-huh.
Loved it.
In a sense, what a great job to just come in and spend a lot of time with other very funny people just being funny and having a good time.
Hopefully that's the way it should be.
Like twice maybe in 30 years it's been like that?
Yeah, maybe once. I remember we were doing a show one time and the guy said to me, is it okay if my nephew comes in? He's 6 years old. And I said, yeah, sure, put him in the corner over there. Mm-hmm. So after it was all over, somebody says to the kid, how do you like it? And the kid says, it's great. You just tell jokes and eat candy.
But it also requires an awful lot of concentration. And you just, it seems effortless. And I've done that job on any number of occasions on various shows. I'm the guy, they all go and try to get Bob first. And when they can't get him, then they say, who else is out there? So I'm kind of like, you know, they want Justin Verlander and they settle for you, Darvish. So, but you're the Justin Verlander. And for me, it's like I come out of those sessions exhausted because I'm really concentrating, trying to be funny the whole time. And you, it just seems to be effortless.
Well, I cheat a little bit.
Old jokes?
No, never. What happens is I try to get the script beforehand.
Uh-huh.
I have it delivered to the house or something like that. There's
right.
going to be a 3 o'clock
right.
run through. I'm jumping on it in the morning.
Okay.
You know, if I can.
Uh-huh.
Figure out what's the problem structurally and take a look at that when we get in. But jokes, I can always find better jokes than just by reading the script. And I'm ahead of the game by the time I get there.
Also, you have, I mean, it's very clear, this very calming influence, which is very helpful in a room because there's a lot of pressure. You come back from the run-through and you're not going home until the script is fixed. And, you know, you're just like, oh my God, are we going to get it? Are we going to get it? And it's really nice just to have somebody who's there and like, yeah, okay, we'll be fine. We'll be fine.
You always have to figure that the answer is in the air. Uh-huh. And you just have to wait and know it when it comes along and grab it. And like that, you can't go in and say it's impossible. We can't find it and never get it.
Right.
And that goes back to way back when I first started. I was working for a press agent, and you had to write jokes for, like, Tony Bennett said this while he was having dinner at that place.
Uh-huh.
And all that. And I was saddled with an IBM industrial typewriter.
Okay.
That shut itself off in 5 minutes. So you'd sit there.
That's pressure.
That's pressure. And you'd sit there and you hear a little click. That was it. Oh, you didn't get it. You didn't get it. Still looking. All right. So, I mean, I think that helped.
And you would do several different shows a week. At one time, weren't you like doing five shows?
Yeah, but that's a trick also. I mean, some of the shows would be on hiatus sometimes.
Right.
So you'd be doing three.
Only four.
But yeah. It's no different than working on one show and working on it every day.
Right.
You know, it's just a different show.
Now, usually
the pay is better. You know?
Yeah. Back then, usually. Yeah. You know, you eat in, and so they would bring in food. How many dinners do you think you've eaten out of styrofoam in your life?
Oh, God. The other downside of that is they knew that I knew a Chinese restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and I could order for them. And I'd come in one day, and they thought they were doing me a big favor by saying, we ordered from your restaurant. You know, so I'd be eating Chinese food 5 nights a week. You know?
But there's actually more to that story. And the story is the Chinese restaurant was Twin Dragons.
Right.
And because Bob would work on all these different shows, they all went to Twin Dragons, and you would order because you knew what you wanted. And eventually, all of the shows in town, if they wanted to get Chinese food for dinner, they would just call up Twin Dragons, and they would say, see, how many we got? Nine people? Yeah. Bob Ellison for 9.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, Bob Ellison for 13. You're kind of like the Arnold Palmer, writers.
In fact, I was watching a show one night, and it involved comedy writers.
Uh-huh.
And they were trying to beat a story out or something. And they say, oh, it's getting late. Let's order from Twin Dragon. It was on the show.
Oh, okay.
So, kind of authentic.
Have you ever actually been to Twin Dragon? Have you ever actually eaten their food off of plates?
Sure, sure. And I think we went back once. The guys from Becker.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And they didn't remember me.
These can also be very long nights from time to time when shows get thrown out. What's the latest rewrite that you can remember?
I would say like 4 in the morning.
Really? Oh man, I got you top. Boy, there were days when the sun was up I would come back. But we didn't have you. Because we would have had you, and you would have pitched all those great jokes. We would have been out at 4.
That's good. I later on developed a thing where I would say, well, I'm not staying past 12. And that would get everybody focused. You know,
uh-huh.
They'd all pitch.
That's a great idea, yeah.
I got it from David Lloyd, you know.
Uh-huh.
He laid down the law, and I'm leaving at this time, and that was it. But I'd stay.
In addition to being a creative consultant for all these years, you mentioned David Lloyd, you also worked on staff of a number of shows, including the Mary Tyler Moore mm-hmm. Show, where you also wrote 15 episodes, some of the truly great episodes. It's, to me, your Sue Ann episodes were always the best. And boy, you talk about a murderer's row in terms of a room.
Mm-hmm.
Who were some of the people in the Mary Tyler Moore Show writing staff room?
It was Stan Daniels, Alan Burns, David uh-huh. Lloyd, Jim Brooks, Ed Weinberger.
Like wow. That. Did it ever bother you that some of your best jokes were credited to somebody else?
No, I don't know that. Nobody wanted to take the blame. No.
And you work on all of these shows. Did you watch them when they came on the air? Were you kind of curious to see what they ultimately came up with and whether this joke worked or whether it didn't?
We figured everything worked before we shot it.
Right.
Because we'd go to a run through
it. Right.
Know pretty well. But yeah, I'd watch the shows. I watched everybody's show.
Uh huh.
I enjoyed that show before I got on it. You know, I was doing variety shows before that.
Mm-hmm.
And.
Which we'll talk about in a minute, yeah.
So, no, it was fun to watch, fun to do, and I loved the cast. You know, there was just nice people. Mary was so complimentary to the writers. She would come over and say, you know, I saw Neil Simon play last night. I got to tell you guys, you know, she loved us.
Uh-huh. And, that's great.
Yeah, it was fun.
For all of us young writers at the time trying to break in, MTM, which produced the Mary Tyler Moore Show, what a coincidence, was like Camelot. We considered mm-hmm. it Camelot. Being on the inside, did it feel that way? Did you get a sense that you were really part of something special at the time it was taking place?
Not really. I hadn't. I came from Variety, so that was the big switch for me. You know, I hadn't worked on a lot of half-hour shows.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't realize how good it was. After the fact, I found out, yeah.
Now you mentioned that you did a lot of variety shows. What is the difference in terms of a writing style from variety to situation comedy?
Well, when you're doing variety shows, you're doing sketches.
Okay.
Basically, no storyline and no
right.
arcs or anything like that.
Right, just how funny you can make it, huh?
Yeah, 6 minutes, 7 minutes, that's it.
Uh-huh.
Sketches. And you had a star and you had a singer and a couple of acts and, you know, break it up a little bit. I did a wonderful show called the Kraft Musical in New York. In New York, there used to be lots of variety shows,
you right.
know, before they faded.
Right. We're talking like the 50s and 60s.
For me, the 60s.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't start in the 50s. I was writing for stand-ups then.
Uh-huh.
A lot of stand-ups.
Who'd you write for?
All of them. And some of them still owe me money. Yeah. they're a strange breed. I don't know if the comics today have writers or they write their own stuff.
Probably but, most write their own stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was different then. I wrote for, like, Pat Henry, who opened for Frank Sinatra,
uh-huh.
which has a tie into something I did later. I wrote for guys like London Lee. You don't know London Lee.
Oh, I've heard the name, yeah. But I'm sure 99.99% of the people listening right now don't know who
yeah.
London Lee was.
I remember seeing him one night. He got a laugh and it scared him. He never heard that sound before.
Which is why we've never heard from him since.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
A lot of guys... Ralph Pope was a guy I wrote for. Because I used to be a musician. And I worked in clubs in New York. And there'd always be a comic on the show. And I would just, like this, out of friendliness, I guess, or because I gravitated towards uh-huh. funny people,
uh-huh.
I'd help write something. And this kid, Ralph Pope, that I worked with in the club, one night we were having coffee between shows. And I had an idea for a Ben Casey sketch.
Okay.
And I pitched it to him. And he did it on the next show downstairs.
Uh-huh.
And it went over well. And he said, I want you to write this out for me. And I said, okay, I'll try. And I did it and I came back and he says, I want to pay you for it. How much? I said, $68.80. You know, I bought a typewriter. That's what it was. I wanted to be reimbursed.
Okay.
So a little Olivetti was a wonderful typewriter. And
didn't shut off after 5 minutes.
No. Uh-huh. Three. Uh-huh. And that's how it started, really.
And you also wrote for a lot of sort of famous people in the variety world. So I'm going to throw some names at you, okay? Dean Martin. You wrote for Dean Martin. What was he like?
Wonderful. Just came in on Sundays, shot the show, no rehearsals. You know, he'd watch somebody stand in or something, do the moves, and jump right in. And it was a loose show. And I remember the first time they introduced me to him. He said, this is one of the writers, this is Bob Ellison. Okay, he says, you keep writing, kid, you're bound to come up with something.
Did he then remember you the next time he saw you, or?
He didn't see anybody.
He was just come floating in, do his thing, and leave.
Huh? One night I had to leave early, and he was closing the show, and he said, everybody loves somebody, something. So that's the end of the show for me. I ran out because I had people waiting for me. And he almost ran over me. I don't know how he did it. But
he left so fast. Yeah. Like in the middle of his song, he's already out the door.
Yeah, it beat me. He was wonderful, you know, on the show. No flubs, no misses, and he added a lot. And
did he ever complain about any of the material?
Never. Uh-huh. Just got up, did it, and made it better. And he's a funny man. He was.
You also wrote for one of my favorite comedians, Alan King.
Yeah. I met Alan when we were doing the Kraft musical. But I did a lot of things with Alan. Alan one year did the Academy Awards.
Oh, so you got to write on the Academy Awards, huh?
Yeah. It was Danny Arnold and Hal Cantor.
Nice. That must be kind of nice knowing that your jokes are being seen by a billion people or whatever.
Yeah. It was good. I worked real hard at it. We went to Vegas first. He was appearing in Vegas and worked on it for about a week and a half. It was the year Chaplin was there. Chaplin liked the monologue.
I remember that year. Yeah. Did you get to meet Chaplin at all?
No.
They just brought him in for the show, and
yeah,
then
he was old, you know.
Yeah.
But he was on a cane and everything.
Well, he always had a cane.
Yeah, that's right.
He had a cane in 1905.
Little derby. Yeah. You know? I had no connection to Charlie Chaplin. I didn't care. And he didn't talk much. You know that.
Right. Yeah.
Don't touch my cane.
Right. You know? I noticed that you did 3 or 4 specials with maybe the funniest guy in Hollywood, Burt Bacharach.
Oh, God.
How did you wind up with Burt Bacharach?
Again, it was the Kraft musical.
Oh, okay. That's how you first met him?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He was very popular at the time. The songs were
great. Right, the songs were great, yeah.
I loved his wife, Angie Dickens.
Yeah.
And she had a great sense of humor.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, you thought it was all looks, huh?
Well, no, it's just that, I love her even more.
Yeah.
I mean, I was tuning around, and on MeTV, there was an old episode of Perry Mason that she was on from, 1958. And it was we're going to stop here. We're going to watch this for a while. Yeah, God, she was gorgeous.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
And she liked that. I used to always try to put Bert on. I'd do pranks on him, you know.
Oh, like what? What kind of pranks?
We wrote a show one time, and he had just done Shangri-La. Was that it? A movie he wrote.
Lost
Horizon, yeah. And there were a lot of kids on the show singing the tunes and everything. And I wrote a thing for one of the kids where he's talking to Bert, and he says, Mr. Bacharach, is Hal David dead? And he says, no, he's alive. He says, why do you ask? He says, well, you never talk about him. And Angie loved that. You know? Yeah, we did 3 specials, and I think 2 of them were done in England.
It must be nice they put you up.
put you up and brought a limo to pick you up in the morning to drive out to the thing.
To write jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then
it's a pretty good job.
Well, it wasn't just jokes for Bird Bacharach. He didn't, you know.
You had to write lyrics?
No. But, you know, just to connect the pieces between the shows. We did one that had Nureyev and Barbara Streisand on it.
Wow.
That was a big show.
Mm-hmm.
So
was he funny?
Nureyev?
Yeah.
We had to write something where they're standing at the piano and reminiscing and thinking of voiceover you'd hear, you know, coming out. How I first met Bert Bacharach. It was at a party and I did this. And so we gave it to Nureyev, and he read it, and he says, "Fuck! I never did this." He wasn't exactly showbiz, you know. but those were big shows, you know. Tom Jones was on it.
Uh-huh.
Barbara Streisand.
Oh, Barbara Streisand. Oh, it's pretty cool that you wrote for Barbara Streisand.
Yeah, she did a thing one day, and then it was like a duet with herself.
Right.
Dwight Emmy.
Yeah, One Less Bell to Answer.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the editing room, and she was there watching the editing, and it was beautiful. And I told her, I said, "You ought to put this on a reel and take it to an agent, you know, you never can tell." Nothing. Not a smile, not a laugh.
You're known for a couple of, like, classic jokes. So now I'm going to ask you whether they really happened, okay? Or whether they're just stories. So they're both attributed to you. One is that you had a pilot and you were in an office watching the rough cut with the network president, and he apparently said, "There's not enough close-ups."
Right?
So, and what did you say?
"Pull up your chair."
Okay, so that one is true. We all love that one. And the other one is, it's a late rewrite night, and you pitch a joke, and apparently the showrunner doesn't really respond to it, and says...
"Too sketchy."
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then what do you say?
No, then I pitch another one, and she said, too jokey.
Uh-huh.
And I says, "Also, 2:30.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one that I never got around, but there was a guy from ABC. Okay, that's done. ABC.
Uh-huh.
And he had two of his henchmen with him.
Uh-huh.
And he came over, and he had just watched the run-through, and he was talking about a sketch we did. And he said, "My Midwestern asshole tells me that's not funny." And I said, "Which one is he?"
You walk with Bob on the lot, and something will happen, and he will come up with a joke so fast. There was a writer colleague of ours who always dressed in black. And Bob and I are walking the lot, and we come across him, and he's wearing a white shirt. And Bob just turns to him and goes, "Who died?"
Yeah.
You know, it's like it seems to come easily to you, though, doesn't it?
It does. It
yeah.
Does. Well, yeah. You got to be, like, always in gear, you know?
Uh-huh. You got to be looking for things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you are a great believer in that.
Yep.
You have to be observant.
Yep.
Know what's going on.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I tell the story that one day I was driving down the 405 freeway coming home from the airport, and I saw this billboard for Wells Fargo that said, "Your retirement starts here." And behind it was Hillside Cemetery. Okay, so I saw that and I laughed, and I thought to myself, how many hundreds of thousands of people drive by, see the same billboard and the same cemetery behind it, and don't make that connection?
Yeah,
you know, it's sure. Just your mind, like, just is geared to see those kind of absurdities.
There used to be one in New York, Lefrak City, and it was a guy holding a baby, and it said, "Daddy, if we lived here, you'd be home now."
Uh-huh.
And my friend Ralph Pope said, "And if I didn't have this baby, I'd be living in New York." Yeah, their signs are good.
Yeah.
Well, you do the same thing with commercials, don't you?
Sure.
You see them. Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
There's a million things in there.
Right. Well, that's one thing, too. In a writing room during a rewrite, the funniest stuff never goes in the script.
Yeah.
The funniest stuff is just between people. So, last question. I want to go back to the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Like I said, you wrote 15 scripts. How long would it take you to write an episode?
I'd say a week.
Uh-huh.
But it was, I wrote longhand on a legal pad. One time I had a legal pad and I put an extension cord on it and I plugged it in just so people would walk by and it's like, what is that? You know, craziness.
Do you still have any of those legal pads? Do you still have any of your handwritten first drafts?
No, no.
Yeah. No, we Larry moved Gelbart to kept everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was wonderful. We moved to New York and I gave away all the scripts that were bound and everything like that.
Uh-huh.
And everything I didn't need, you know, it was a small apartment.
Right.
Compared to the big house we had here.
Right.
So that's all gone.
Right. Well, Bob, this has really been great. Thank you so much. When David and I would get a show on the air, our first call was always to you. And
Big Wave Dave.
Big Wave Dave's.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes. And, you know, listeners of this podcast know what a mega hit Big Wave Dave's was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. The rest of the world does not. But
it was
the people
great
listening
in the room.
To...
It was great in the room. People loved it.
Yeah. We had a really good time. Bob, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. This went flying by.
Okay, there you go. That was my interview with the great Bob Ellison from 5 years ago. Again, Bob passed away about a week ago at the age of 91. I wish I could convey to you just how funny he was in a room. And he would be there hour after hour after hour, just pitching great, great jokes. I will really, really miss him. Okay, that'll do it for this edition of Hollywood and Levine. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolfert, and Bruce and Jason Miller. If you want to get in touch with me, hollywoodlevine@outlook.com is my email address. That is hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. Also, I am on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Thanks so much for listening. Back again next week right here on
Hollywood and Levine.